I want to take an opportunity first and foremost to thank FFA for the opportunity to be here today. This is a wonderful organization, and these young people are just absolutely amazing. Phenomenally articulate. They happen to be, I think, some of the best ambassadors for agriculture, for farming, for rural areas, and I know that there are urban members of FFA as well, and we're now seeing an expansion of farming in all parts of the country, and I think in large part it's being led by the young people and that audience today and young people like them over the last several years. Two messages. One, that it is important, I think, for the future of agriculture that we do indeed embrace diversity. And when I use the word diversity, I mean it in every context. First of all, we are obviously faced with some challenges relative to making sure we have enough people doing the jobs that need to be done. As the Purdue study suggested, we still have work to do in that space. Diversity in terms of understanding that with an aging farming population, we're going to have to continue to look for ways in which we can encourage more young people to get into this business, and that's why we have focused on beginning farm and rancher development. It's why we have created new loan programs like the microloan program. We obviously have the youth program, the FSA, now over 9,000 young people participating in that program now. We've looked at ways in which we can make our conservation programs more readily available to beginning farmers. We've looked at risk management, crop insurance premiums, and reducing them for new farmers. We've even looked at ways in which we can begin to have a conversation about this land transfer that's going to take place in the next 10, 15 years in this country and how we can make it more readily available to beginning farmers. So we looked at all of that, and we recognized that one of our challenges is that at times our loan programs can be require a significant amount of documentation and are oftentimes not as readily available as they potentially could be. So we're looking at today at making an expansion of our loan capacity by developing what we refer to as the Easy Loan Guarantee Program. And the way this will work is that if young farmers, beginning farmers, are interested in borrowing money up to $100,000, we're going to make it a little easier with less documentation, a little quicker to get that loan guarantee with the financial institution through this new Easy Loan Guarantee Program. And we're also expanding the eligibility of lending under this program to include community development, financial institutions, CDFIs, and other non-traditional lenders so that we continue to expand the scope, the capacity, the resources available to farmers regardless of where they might be, if they're in a very rural area or even if they're in an urban center. All of this is designed to support the notion of diversity, both in terms of size of operations, in terms of the actual farmers. A lot of young women in that audience today, and the message there obviously is that this is not necessarily a male-dominated industry anymore, and it doesn't need to be, and it shouldn't be. A lot of people of color are interested and excited about participating in agricultural activities. They need to be encouraged. And it's also diversity in terms of crop production methods. This is no longer a situation where there's only one way to do this. There are multiple ways, and we want to be supportive of all of those ways. It's diversity in terms of size of operation. It could be a 5-acre organic farm. It could be a 5,000-acre ranch. We want to be supportive of all types of agriculture. And the fundamental reason for that is that it's agriculture that's the foundation of our economy, and we want to make sure that it continues to prosper. Obviously, there are challenges today for some producers with low commodity prices, and we're obviously looking at ways in which we can expand market opportunity, whether it's through local and regional food systems and the investments we've made there, whether it's promoting the bio-based economy and creating new market opportunities here domestically and bringing manufacturing back to rural areas, or whether it's a new way of approaching conservation for regulated industries and corporations that are interested in social welfare responsibilities, or whether it's expanding market opportunities overseas through trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So all of that's taken place, and all of it, it underscores the need for us to continue to encourage more people to get involved and these young people to convey a message about agriculture so that people in this country understand and appreciate precisely what it is, and that we're not in a situation of us versus them. As some have suggested, it's not a situation in which it's big versus small. It's a situation in which all forms of agriculture, all sizes of agriculture, all types of producers are welcome in this thing, in American agriculture. So with that, I'd be happy to take questions. Well, I think it's incumbent upon us to continue the education initiative that will be underway with the new labeling law. It's going to give consumers the ability to understand and appreciate the choices that they have, and because of the choice, the competition for their consuming dollar, and that range and options that they have. And I think hopefully they'll grow to appreciate that the market is attempting to provide a broad array, a diverse choice, if you will. You know, I do think it's important for there to be an important conversation between consumers, between food processing companies, folks who sell food, and folks who produce food. And I will use an example of a recent meeting we've had with some of the egg industry. There's been a rush to promote cage-free eggs. In fact, on my menu this morning, there was the option of cage-free eggs. And some companies and some hotel chains and some restaurants have made commitments to go cage-free by a date certain. They did this in isolation. They did this as a marketing effort without any thought about precisely how many of these commitments were being made and essentially how the market was going to react. Well, turns out that we have roughly 17 million layers today that are cage-free eligible. To meet all of the commitments that have been made and all the promises that have been made by the dates that all have promised will require over 200 million layers. So then the question is, well, geez, how much is that going to cost? It turns out it's going to cost about $8 billion. Okay. So if you ask producers to make that investment of $8 billion, the 100 or so egg-producing organizations and operations, say, hey, spend that money because that's what the market wants. Then you ask the question, how will consumers be with all of this if it turns out that that increases the cost of a dozen eggs by X? Well, there's still uncertainty about that. It may be that the consumers go, oh, well, geez, we didn't know there was a cost associated with this. Now that we know that, we'll just stick with the conventionally produced eggs. That's an important conversation that isn't taking place, that needs to take place. So it sort of enlarges on your question. That I think there has to be as we deal with all of these issues in agriculture, I don't think we want to stop the conversation. I don't think we want to say, hey, we're against animal welfare or we're against cage-free eggs or whatever. I think we want to say, let's have a full conversation about all of this. Let's make sure we understand exactly what we're talking about, and let's make sure we understand what the cost is, not just what the benefit is, but what the cost is. And then let the consumer weigh all of that. And if the consumer says, by golly, I'm willing to pay a nickel more for something or 10 cents more for something, then the market's going to respond, and appropriately so. My concern is I don't think we have the full conversation. And I think the labeling law that was passed by Congress that we're now in the process of implementing is the beginning of a much larger and important conversation so that consumers sort of understand the choices they have, understand the price differential between those choices, and then they're going to make the decision. I think if you did a survey and you asked the question, as American consumers, would you currently paying 10% of your paycheck for food, would you be okay if you paid 15 or 20% of your paycheck for food? And you just asked that question. My guess is the vast majority of people would say, well, why am I paying more? Okay, here's why you're paying more. Maybe I'm okay with that. Maybe I'm not okay with that. But those questions aren't being asked. And these commitments being made as a reaction to campaigns and social media, I think have to be more thoughtfully made. And there has to be a more mature conversation about all of this so that we can gauge the costs, the benefits, the timelines to make sure that whatever commitments are being made are reasonable. and that we're not asking producers to spend a lot of money only to find out that they can't recoup those costs and still be profitable. Yes. Yeah. Well, here's the news flash. We've been having this conversation. We at USDA have been having this conversation for a long time. It's just, for whatever reason, people may not have fully understood how engaged we have been in this conversation. There has been consistency, at least as long as I've been secretary, about the safety of GMO-produced crops and food made with GMO crops. There's no food safety issue here. Despite what people may say, there just is not. That has been consistent. We need to continue to make sure that there is no misinformation about the safety of food that's generated from GMO. Secondly, we need to make sure that folks understand the conservation benefits that can accrue from the use of GMO technology in terms of pesticides and chemical application. Having said that, that's not going to satisfy everyone. There are going to be some folks who want choice. There are going to be some folks who want a different production method for the food that they consume, and they should have that choice. They should absolutely have that choice. And the USDA should not be in a position of saying one is better than the other, in my view, because what you do then is you divide agriculture, and agriculture in terms of the population of this country is less than 1% of the population. We need to have a much broader conversation with the other 99%. We shouldn't be fighting within agriculture. That's why the diversity message is important. You know, respect everyone's right to produce food the way they wish to produce it. Let the market make the decision, and make sure that the market is adequately informed and that you're communicating the truth about products. And in that circumstance, I think agriculture wins. I think folks understand that they can try a multitude of ways to produce food. I think they can recognize that they don't necessarily have to be a large operation to be in the farming business. That's why we have invested so much in local and regional food systems. We want to give people diverse options, choices of markets. If you have a small producer and you're producing a commodity and you're selling that commodity based on a commodity price, commodity prices reward efficiency, large-scale, technology-driven operations. Many producers, small producers, are not going to be able to successfully compete in that game. They need their own game. And their own game is a local and regional food system where consumers are willing to pay a penny or two more for something because they know the farmer. They like going to a farmer's market. They like the idea that their kids in schools are consuming something that was purchased 5 miles down the road. They like going into a restaurant and knowing that they're supporting a local farmer. There's nothing wrong with that. That's good stuff. We want to promote that. But we shouldn't promote it at the expense of suggesting that large-scale agriculture is wrong, or that our large-scale agriculture isn't just as equally important to this country. It has competed, and it'll continue to compete. Yes. It's only because you're wearing that red. See, Ron, if you'd worn red today, I would have asked you. Well, I think there's urgency in beginning the conversation appropriately, and that's what I've been stressing to audiences that I've talked to and groups I've talked to. The conversation in 2011-12 started with, we have to save money. That was how the conversation started. Somebody determined artificially and arbitrarily that they had to save $23 billion. Boy, once you start the farm bill conversation that way, it becomes very difficult. Because then you've got the cotton guys going, well, you know, the stacks program doesn't work in all circumstances. You've got the milk guys say, you know, the margin protection program works in some places, not as well in other places. You got the conservation people saying, hey, don't keep robbing the conservation title to pay for it. You got the CRP need now when $8 corn, maybe CRP wasn't as attractive. Today, people want to be involved in CRP. You can't have those conversations if you start with, we got to save money. The first way to start this conversation should be, what is the need? What is the total need? It may be significantly higher than what we're spending today, fair enough, but what's the total need? And then once we've defined that universe, then let's be creative about how to meet as many of those needs as we possibly can. So I think the urgency is in starting the conversation the right way. I fear that we will start it the same way we have started it in the last couple of rounds, and that is we got to save money. Well, you start that, then you pit everybody against each other, and you make it a lot more difficult to get a farm bill through. And I'm very concerned about the conversation that takes place when people say, well, you know, one way to do this is by taking the nutrition title and getting out of the farm bill, because all that money that we're spending on nutrition somehow magically will flow into the farm programs. No, that's not what's going to happen. That is not what's going to happen. That money will flow someplace outside of our universe, if you will. It's important to keep that coalition together, and it's important that that coalition understand that they're in it together, that a nutrition program is a nutrition program, but is also part of the farm program, because if people can buy more at the grocery store, they will, and if they buy more, then more has to be produced and packaged and processed, and at the end of the day, it provides stability in markets. So my hope is that the conversation starts the right way, and that it moves expeditiously to a conclusion, so that there is not the uncertainty that we had in 2011, 12, 13, and not the threat that I had to eventually make, which was, okay, we'll go back to permanent law and see how that works. That was a pretty significant threat, and eventually people responded and got a farm bill passed. Not perfect, but you know, we sent out billions of dollars of assistance in the ARC and PLC program, probably $2 to $2.5 billion more than we did the previous year. Our CRP payments are going out this month, so there's a little bit of help coming to get people through a tough time, and that's really what a farm bill, part of what a farm bill should do. Guy, you're a good guy. I'll answer your question.
Your access to the media down through the years.
I didn't know I had a choice. You're telling me now I had a choice? Wow.
Gypsum. Why now?
Why not? Look, there are circumstances. When I came into this job, I spoke with North Carolina producers, poultry producers, who felt that they were unfairly treated with Pilgrim's Pride and the bankruptcy of Pilgrim's Pride. They were told and encouraged to spend a lot of money to upgrade their facilities, and then, without any warning, and without much time to find alternative markets, they were told they were basically out of business. That's not fair, in my view, and the view of a lot of people. So we are trying to correct the unfairness that exists in the market today, to try to create a situation where folks have at least reasonable protections, notice, the ability to respond, time to respond, to be able to deal with a situation like that. There is also uncertainty in the rules today. And I think there is a clamoring in the countryside for what exactly are the rules, what's the line, where is it drawn, how is it defined, so that we understand and appreciate what our rights are, what our responsibilities are. You know, the mistake we make in crafting legislation is that we don't craft it with specificity, and therefore you need regulations to create the specificity that allows the market to understand precisely what is acceptable and what is unacceptable. Today there's uncertainty about that. And when you have uncertainty, then you have circumstances and situations where people can be taken advantage of. So I think so that's the first reason. The second reason is we actually moved on this before. Congress came in and stopped it. And then Congress reversed itself and said, you know what, now that we think about it, it's okay, you can go ahead and do it. And now there's a split in Congress. So that's the reason. I mean, if Congress had not done what they did several years ago, we would have those rules in place today, and we would be talking about something else. All right? Thank you all.